Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bowling.
Ben, today's topic is one that people may think we've already covered in the past because we have done a lot of engine shows. And I kind of went through our RSS feed and looked at a bunch of the engine shows that we've done in the past. And we've done Harley engines, tank engines, rotating detonation engines, which was a complex one. Jet engines, rotary engines, fire engines. I'm just kidding. That's not really an engine.
Well, no, we did one on fire trucks, though.
Fire trucks. I think we called them fire engines, though.
We did. So technically,
it's not really an engine.
I'm going to give you half points on that one.
All right. I threw that in there. I saw Stirling engines, diesel engines, steam engines, all kinds of engines.
Yeah.
But what separates today's show from those other shows is that this isn't just one type of engine that we're going to focus on. It's a lot of different types of engines. And every single one of these, for some reason, is overly complex.
Yeah, they're maybe not needlessly complicated, because we're going to find that in several cases there were engineering specifications or constraints that they wanted to fit.
Sure. Or the technology just wasn't there yet, you know, at the point when these were developed. Like, it was the early form of that type of engine, so this is the only way they had to do it, and that kind of makes sense for some of these. But for a lot of them, they just seem like they've tried to add just a couple of things too many to these engines that make them not operate in the way that they should.
Yeah, we're going to see that there are some fairly good engines here, but there are also a lot of stinkers.
Yeah, but you know what? Yeah. I shouldn't say that, you know, that they didn't operate the way they should, because there's some that were fantastic.
That's true.
But the thing is, they're so complex. They're so difficult to work on, to understand, to engineer, to repair.
Yeah.
That, you know, that they're just not feasible for a typical production car.
Some of them, one or two, remind me of like a Rube Goldberg machine, just the level of complexity.
A little bit, yeah. Some of them do.
And I'll point that one out when we get to it. You want to just dive in?
Yeah, sure. So we're kind of following along with an article that was from Jalopnik.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called "The 10 Most Complicated Engines Ever Made" is the name of their article. And these suggestions came from their listeners. And what we've done is, at least in my notes here, I've gone through and I've added a bunch of material. So, you know, you can go there and get the main story and see some of these photos and some of the diagrams of the engines if you'd like. But we're going to add quite a bit of information to each one of these and kind of make this our own in a way.
Right. Yeah. Because we have also included just a little bit something extra for you guys for each of these.
Starting with the intro, because the very first paragraph, did you see what it mentioned there? Camless engines?
Yes.
Now, They interviewed a guy who's the founder of Koenigsegg.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Christian von Koenigsegg.
Oh.
And he's what they call the father of Sweden's hypercars in the article, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they interviewed him. Jalopnik actually interviewed this guy at the Geneva Motor Show, and he told them that, you know, in about 10 years or so, automobile engines won't have camshafts anymore. He said he's been working on camless engines for a while now.
Yeah.
But it's not just that company that's doing it. There's several other companies that are working on this, including Renault, BMW, GM, Ricardo, Lotus, Ford, and Valeo. So it looks like this is something that's going to happen, but we're just not seeing it quite yet. And, you know, a couple of things that we need to mention here. Fiat already has something that they call the electro-hydraulic variable valve actuation technology that they use in something called their multi-air engine.
Mm-hmm.
And the multi-air engines are actually in production, but it's not exactly camless yet. I mean, it still has a cam. But what it is where the air intake is controlled without a throttle valve, but it's still a gasoline engine. And Fiat patented this in around, I think it was about 2002, in a very small engine, a 1.4-liter engine. But it was given the Best New Engine of 2010 award. So you can see that, you know, it's a great design, and they're working on it. They're working towards a camless design, but they're not quite there yet. And that's just one example of, like, what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
There's engine development happening all the time from the early 1900s on, actually way before that. But we're going to talk about, I think, our earliest examples from about 1904, somewhere
right
in there.
You're right.
So, you know, let's start at number 10, maybe. And that's a more recent addition, right?
Yes, number 10, the Volkswagen W8. So Volkswagen has a reputation for, you know, engine innovation, right? And as you mentioned earlier, Scott, the automobile engine has been a continual work in progress since its creation. the W8 goes right along with Volkswagen's traditions. But man, this thing is weird. So it's a compact 4-liter engine, Scott, but it is not it's not what you're thinking of right now, unless you've seen a picture of it, because in the Jalopnik article, they describe it as a flat plane crank V8 engine combining two narrow angle VR4 engine blocks that share a crankshaft.
That sounds like a complicated way to say that. It just seems like it's, and I know that's the exact description of it.
Right.
But if you think of it, it's a squished together V8 is what it looks like.
Right. And that's the thing, because it can still fit in the same area that a V6 would.
Yeah, about a V6. Yeah. I mean, a 4-cylinder maybe is a little bit smaller, but probably approximately like the size of a V6 maybe.
So
it's pretty strong too.
Yeah, yeah. Give me some stats.
271 horsepower and 270 pound-feet of torque, which is not bad out of this tiny little V8. I mean, it's really small. Here's how small it is. It was installed in the VW Passat, which is a wagon.
Yeah.
The wagon, you know, design of that vehicle anyways is the one that used this. And I think about 10,000 of these were built each year. Between 2001 and 2004. And the thing was that, you know, this engine was installed longitudinally in the Passat.
Right.
From about, again, September to September of, from 01 to 04. And then at the 2005 redesign for the Passat wagon, the design called for a transverse mounted engine, and the W8 simply wouldn't fit into the engine at that point.
Yeah, it was just too big, so they had to get the 3.6 liter VR6, right?
That's right, and that's what replaced this whole thing. Now, the sound from these engines is pretty incredible. I mean, I don't know if you've listened to any of the audio of these things. We used to have one here at this building. I know that when I was leaving the structure a couple of times, I remember seeing a Passat with a W8 badge on the back of it, and it sounded pretty good. It didn't sound like the ones that I hear in the video, so I'm assuming that there's a lot of exhaust work that goes on in some of these, you know, that people put online. But some of the sounds that come out of this engine are just incredible, especially when you see it, you know, combined with that, the visual of the Passat wagon, it just doesn't seem to match up. It's kind of a strange mix, but they sound so great.
Yeah, wait, I've got to ask, though, the person that you saw here, was their engine running quieter or louder?
Quieter than the videos.
Okay.
It sounded louder than a typical Passat should have.
For sure.
In my mind. I mean, it sounded, it has that interesting V8 burble, you know, that crazy V8 sound that, you know, it's the loping sound that we all know. Right?
Yeah.
Not quite like a hot rod or something like that, but it's impressive nonetheless.
Yeah, you can definitely hear the difference. Speaking of different things, our next engine is surprisingly small.
Yeah, it's very small, actually. It's the Lancia Abarth Triflex engine. Now, that's a mouthful. Mm-hmm. And this was supposed to be, this is the trick to this whole thing, Ben. This was supposed to be a Group S rally car engine originally from Lancia. Now, the thing is that Group S, was canceled along with Group B following that 1986 accident. Remember they canceled it for, I believe it was for the 87 season.
Yeah.
And we've talked about Group B rally in the past, those crazy, car, you know, the crazy rally scenes where people are lining the road and nearly getting squished every time someone, you know, makes a jump.
Yeah.
Amazing stuff. This was to be used in a vehicle called the ECV1, which was, the experimental composite vehicle. And it was sort of a, you remember we talked about a car called a Delta S4? That Lancia powered?
Yeah, yeah.
It was supposed to be the replacement car for the Delta S4, but it was a very, very light vehicle because it used these experimental composite materials on the body.
Mm-hmm.
So interesting history that goes along with this whole thing. And I'll tell you, the operation of this, if we were to read this, it would take too long. It's really...
It's its own episode.
It's definitely its own episode. And there's going to be a couple of those in this. But you can read all about this at the Jalopnik article if you like, you know, as far as the way the airflow goes and et cetera. But I do want to say this.
Yeah.
I found this from a reader in a note, and they had looked up the stats or the specs on this engine. This is a 1.8 liter engine. This engine pushed out 455 horsepower per liter. That's how strong this engine was. So it's nearly 2 liters, and it puts out 455 per liter. That's incredible. What a strong engine, perfect for rally racing.
See, now people who said, 1.8 liter, not worth my time, now you guys are going to go check it out.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly right. So let's jump on to number 8.
That's right, Scott. The Porsche Firman. This thing is a beast. So Porsche, some of you may be familiar with this car company.
I would think that some people would be.
Right. They were living high on the hog when they set about to refine and finesse the 550. So they had the original engine in there was a push rod, 1500S, and it's described in our Jalopnik article as a tweaked Volkswagen power plant.
All right. So here's what's going on. The Porsche 550 is, you know, the production was from 1953 to 1956, and they were trying to refine what was already there, right? So this guy, they contact this guy, Ernest Furman, and Furman creates what they called a sophisticated engine, you know, that would be fitting of a Le Mans winning mark, right? So in other words, it's overly complicated really in a lot of ways, but it's a very strong, very, very, very powerful engine. So the Type 547 engine, which they call an incredibly complicated roller bearing equipped quad cam.
Quad cam.
Yeah. Now he says these first four cam engines took a skilled man 120 hours to assemble and complete the engine. And the timing alone could take between 8 and sometimes 15 hours if the tolerances were not just right. So timing alone to set on this engine, timing which is usually just a quick operation,
right,
doesn't
right.
take very long at all, takes between 8 and 15 hours on this engine. That's incredible. And the whole thing about assembling the engine, I mean, a skilled assembly person, 120 hours to put together this engine. I mean, that's
crazy.
And you know the size of a Porsche engine. It's not an overly huge engine or anything like that. It's just that complex.
And to underline the point about the complexity, you can check out online. There are some images of a disassembled Furman. Did you see those?
Yeah, I guess like the exploded views.
Yeah, which I love those things, man.
I do too.
And they have all of the pieces, you know, neatly arranged, semi in relation to where they would be.
Oh, that takes so long to set those up. And can you imagine with this, mm-hmm. this engine, how long that would take?
That's what really got me because, you know, when you see that, you want to start putting it together in your mind, mm-hmm. and it just blew me away.
Well,
man.
It's like every model that you've ever put together, you know, like the plastic models.
Yeah.
They all have those exploded views, and it's like, wait a minute, is that right? You know, try to lay everything out and put it together. It's difficult to do in your mind, but when you see it all together, it all makes sense.
That's true. That's a good point. Let's see. Now we're on to number 7, the Oldsmobile Jetfire. Here's the thing. 1962, right? That's mm-hmm. that's when this engine comes out.
Sure.
It's aluminum.
Yeah, that's one remarkable part.
Yeah, that's just one, though. There's some other stuff as well, right? Turbocharged, water-injected. Oh, I should say it's a V8.
Yep, turbo V8 by Oldsmobile way back in 1962. And they produced this from 1962 to 1963. And again, it's a turbocharged version of the 215 engine, which, again, all aluminum V8 back in 1962.
That's crazy.
That's pretty incredible. You know, it was a 215 engine. Coincidentally, it had 215 horsepower, mm-hmm. but 300 pound-feet of torque. So that's pretty strong. And one thing that grabbed me about this this entry here is this bottle that's in the image here for this entry.
Turbo rocket fluid.
Yeah, there's a bottle that has, like, this white milky-looking material in it that says turbo rocket fluid. And you had to use that in your car. How cool is that?
Yeah, it's the water alcohol mix, right?
Yeah, it's this. Yeah, you have to use that to suppress the engine knock because you know it's aluminum, it's turbo, it's all that stuff, right? So you suppress this the knock with this water alcohol mixture that came in this really cool looking old bottle with you know skull and crossbones on it.
Uh-huh.
How awesome would that be to use that in your car, like for a real purpose?
Yeah, that's true. So it's not just some ornamental thing. But,
exactly right.
But what happens if you run out of turbo rocket fluid, Scott?
Well, then you've got severe engine knock because it had a very high compression ratio. It had a 10.25-1 compression ratio, and again, that's back in 1962. The fuel just wasn't there at that point. You had to have this. You had to have this extra add-in. You know, this water alcohol mix to make it work.
So this next one is just crazy. I think that sometimes in the never-ending quest for innovation, we as a species figure out if we can do something, but we never ask ourselves if we should.
Yeah, and that is the case with number 6, which is the Sazeta V16T.
You heard it right, folks. V16.
Yeah, and the idea behind this, if you want to buy into what they're saying here, is that the idea was to out Lambo Lamborghini, and that's kind of a funny way to say it, but you know, they come equipped with 12 cylinder engines. This one has 16, so that's just that much better.
And it's almost like a system of engines, you know what I mean? Because
yeah.
the transmission is in the middle of the transmission is at the heart of this.
Yeah, here's the crazy thing. Now, you know, most people can probably picture a V16 engine and they're enormous, right?
They're
gigantic.
Yeah.
This is transverse mounted. So it's in the back, right behind the driver and passenger, but it's a transverse mounted V16 engine. So, the idea is that, you know, with a transmission in the middle as well. So this becomes like a V8 engine, transmission, and then a V8 engine.
Yeah.
If you can picture that in your mind. Now that's crazy. I know to think about it that way, but I also want to tell you this. It's not really two engines as they depict it here. It's really one engine because it does have a common block. I looked this engine up.
Yeah, it does.
And it is a common block. So it's really not like two V8s stuck together. It's one continuous V8 engine or V16 engine. And if you look at the design, I mean, it's extremely wide. It's like a full lane of traffic wide. It's really, really wide vehicle and low. But it looks extremely close to the Lamborghini Diablo in design. I mean, very, very close. And it's got these crazy looking pop-up headlamps. I don't know if you saw this photo.
Yeah.
But the headlamps are like, the pop-up headlamps on.
And they're like double mounted.
Old Corvette. Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. How do you, like, they're stacked.
Yeah, it's a four eyes vehicle.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, side by side like you might think with a pop-up headlamp. Mm-hmm. They're stacked like one on top of the other one. It's just bizarre look.
Tandem seating for the headlights.
Very, very strange. But the Sezeta V16T is an unusual vehicle and extremely wide. And again, overly complex. They didn't have to stuff a V16 in there. And from what I hear, you know, performance was about what other supercars were at the time. So it didn't really gain them anything to go up to V16. But still, it's got supercar performance. So,
yeah.
you win some. Right?
What price can you put on hyperbole? You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly right.
A lot of people will do anything to get that EST at the end.
That's probably
biggest,
true.
Fastest. All right. So speaking of weird things, Scott, this is one that I'm hoping you can explain to me a little bit.
Maybe.
We'll all see. Right. You ready? Let's give it a shot.
All right.
The Saab variable compression.
Oh, this is tough. All right. So this is the SVC engine, and I'll tell you what I can about this one because I quickly looked it up just to see what's going on here, but this is going to take a lot more investigation to figure out what's happening.
Yeah.
All right. So the idea is that the Saab engine has variable compression through a tiltable block. Now, the block actually moves. It pivots.
Right.
And this is so strange. I mean, it's got normal internal combustion engine operation other than, you know, this flexible block. Now, that's the big asterisk on this one, right?
Right.
Now, because the cylinder bore diameter, the piston stroke length, and the combustion chamber volume are almost always constant, the compression ratio for a given engine is almost always constant as well, right?
Yeah.
So this engine, though, that was designed for the Saab 9.5, uses a technique that dynamically alters the volume of the combustion chamber, which changes the compression ratio.
Right. Yeah, and it does this by tilting.
Yeah, it tilts this, but what's really happening is the SVC lowers the cylinder head closer to the crankshaft, and it does it by replacing the one-piece engine block with a two-part block,
mm-hmm.
and with the crankshaft in the lower block and the cylinders in the upper portion of the block, the two block parts are kind of hinged together at one side, and then it pivots the upper block around the hinge point so that the volume of the combustion chamber can be modified. So the SVC adjusts the upper block through a small range of motion using a hydraulic actuator, and that's how they draw it down or back up again. And I know that sounds extremely complex, and it is, and you'll have to look at a diagram to totally get what's going on there.
Yeah.
But this was patented by a guy from Lakeland, Florida, here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually slated to be a production engine, and the SVC project was, you know, on the books. It was ready to go in the Saab 9.5 when General Motors bought, Saab. But General Motors decided to shelve it because it was just way too expensive to produce this thing.
Right, but this is one of the engines that people are super impressed with because this one won an award in 2000 and 2001 for its development. This is our first, I think, award-winning engine on the list.
No, no, I had that other one that won the best of, but you know what? It's not on the list. You're right. It's a technicality. you're right. That is the first one on the list. I was thinking of the Camless engine that we talked about.
Oh, yeah.
The,
no.
The Fiat Multi-Air.
Well, that's an intro.
Yeah, I added that one.
Okay.
All right. So,
all right. I guess, you know what?
Working off of two separate sets of notes.
Let's call it a draw.
I'd say you win that one.
Well, that's, you're too kind. But, speaking of vehicles that did not win awards, let's go to, you like that intro?
I do.
Let's go to the Cadillac 864, which I've got a little bit of stuff on here. So, you know, General Motors pops up again. You'll recognize them as the guys who canceled the Saab project earlier. They wanted the world to still drive Cadillacs, but have more fuel efficient Cadillacs. So they came up with a nifty process that they were going to implement called cylinder deactivation. Spoiler alert, this did not work.
But it worked about 2.5 decades later.
It didn't work in the beginning.
No, it didn't work in the beginning. And Ben, can I tell you something? This is one that we've mentioned on the show before because my grandfather had a Cadillac with an 864 engine and it was just, it was a thorn in his side.
was it really?
It really was. It was always giving him trouble. I mean, there was not a day when he wasn't talking about how bad this engine was.
I think I do remember you mentioning this on the
show. Yeah, exactly right. I mean, just the whole thing about this engine design with the cylinder deactivation and everything, it was a good idea. And they called it modulated displacement, I think. And that's what Cadillac called it at the time in 1981. And that's the year the vehicles that it was released on, these 1981 mm-hmm. Caddies. And it really didn't quite work out because the electronics were just not there until when Chrysler tried it about 24 years later they came out with that Hemi engine that had that multi-displacement system.
Yeah, yeah.
And that one worked really well, and everything was fine there. But, you know, at the time, in 1981, Cadillac called this a technical masterpiece. And they made it standard equipment across the entire Cadillac lineup, which was a mistake because mm-hmm. it's a big V8. Has 140 horsepower, 265 pound-feet of torque, so it's a low horsepower, big V8, big, huge chunk of metal under the hood, and it's a big vehicle. If you look at the 81 Caddies, they're still big.
Yeah.
Still enormous boats, you know, land yachts. And they tried to make them more fuel efficient, you know, being able to deactivate cylinders so that, you know, it's either operating on 8 cylinders, 6 cylinders, or 4 cylinders. Mm-hmm. And that's the idea, right?
Right, yeah. So here's how it works. Which is still kind of funny to me when one of us says how it works or how stuff works. You'd think we'd get tired of that joke.
Yeah,
it always gives me a chuckle.
We don't.
Well, we haven't yet, right?
Clearly not.
So clearly I'm not tired of it. Yeah. So cylinder deactivation. The solenoids are mounted to the rocker arm studs of the cylinders, right? And they disengage the fulcrums. And what happens there is that the rockers just kind of float. And the valves are closed despite the push rods still being in motion. So you can look under the hood of a Caddy and you can tell if you're looking at this kind of engine because, they have the covers for the rockers that have elevated sections on them, right?
Yeah, over just two of the cylinders, right?
Over just two. Great point. Right. And when the valves are closed, the cylinders act as air springs. So that eliminates the feel of missing, right?
When
you feel like it's missing a beat.
Now, that's the thing. Like, I thought that, you know, if you deactivate cylinders, you're going to feel like it's missing. Like, you're going to feel like this car is way low on power and I'm pushing the gas pedal down. It's just not operating the way it should. Right.
Right.
But that's what they didn't want it to feel like. They wanted it to feel like continuous power.
Right. Yeah. And so, this also keeps the cylinders warm so they can reactivate easily and jump in with the rest of the active cylinders. One thing that's interesting is there was a display there that they called a mile per gallon MPG Sentinel mm-hmm. that would pop up and tell you how many cylinders you have, 4, 6, or 8, your current fuel consumption, how far you could go based on the amount of fuel remaining in your tank. I mean, this is all neat stuff, right?
Yeah, for 1981 as well.
Yeah, heck, I mean, yeah. Oh, it's a digital display.
Yeah,
say that.
Not bad. I mean, 1981, you would expect something like this in the vehicle, right?
Yeah.
The problem was all this stuff didn't really work all that well.
Yeah, not in practice. The solenoids were often crapping out.
Yeah, they said, you know, in the article here, they say it was the malaise era engineering at its finest.
And yeah.
I agree. I mean, I think that there was a pretty dismal time in the American auto industry right around there when, you know, these electronics just weren't working right. They didn't have it exactly, you know, fine tuned the way that they should.
Yeah.
And so the cylinders would often ping as if it was running on 4 or 6 cylinders, but just because it didn't have the correct EGR system, it just wasn't sounding correctly. You know, it wasn't
right.
People felt when those cylinders would deactivate when they were in practice were not supposed to feel when that happened. It was supposed to be just smooth power throughout. And, again, this is a big, heavy, 8-cylinder engine, so fuel savings were actually pretty minimal. And there was a lot of maintenance, a lot of repairs that went along with this as well. But there were some fixes. You know, there were some things that you could do to change this. And, GM would have its, programming fixes that it would do, et cetera. But if you would take it to a local mechanic, they would kind of bypass the whole system because they could disable the cylinder deactivation to allow the engine to run on 8 cylinders at all time. And just completely bypass the 6-4 part of the engine. Right.
And there's another thing here that's tangentially related. If I could tell you a little bit of a story about a related engine.
Sure.
Okay. The HT4100, which was the, a Cadillac attempt to further pursue these EPA fuel requirements, which, we call CAFE standards here. And a lot of people can get the 864 and the HT4100 confused. The 864 is 1981, just that one year, right? Mm-hmm. HT4100, 92 through 85 to pursue these CAFE standards, and by far like the worst one of those. I've heard it called the worst engine in Cadillac history.
Yeah.
Have you heard it?
I have not, because I've always heard the 864 was the worst.
So, there's a lot of misinformation there about what the HT4100 actually does, but the 864 and I'll just call it the HT now, are very different. HT4100 is a tiny aluminum block. It's a 4.1 liter, cast iron heads. Let me just read this real quick for you. It had very little power, even less torque, with a small transmission that failed often, and tiny differential behind it. In other words, if you wanted to change an HT4100 to a better motor, it goes much deeper than just the motor. Way deeper. It often failed before 20,000 miles in its first year.
No way.
I know. Can you believe it? And so I just want to put out a little bit of a PSA to listeners out there that you might hear some of your buddies saying really bad things about the 864. In addition to those being true, they might also be talking about this other engine.
Oh man, that's pretty bad. I hadn't heard about that one, but, let me just say one last thing about the 864. This kind of proves it, I guess, Ben. It made it onto the Time Magazine 50 Worst Cars of All Time list, the 1981 Cadillac Fleetwood V864. So it was officially labeled as one of the 50 worst cars of all time by Time Magazine. I think it was somewhere in the middle. It was like 31 or something like that, but I don't know if they're actually in order. And I do think that, we mentioned that it was just 81, but I think they continue production of that 864 for special vehicles, like for limos and, want to say hearses, but maybe that's not right.
Uh-huh.
Some specialty Cadillac vehicles, I believe, carried the 864 through 1984. But as far as passenger vehicles go, the ones that were available to the general public,
mm-hmm.
On the dealer lots, I believe 1981 was it. So you're right.
So, here's the question, though. What would have happened if Cadillac had kept working on the 864 instead of going straight to this HT4100.
I don't know. They might have ended up going mad in the laboratory, because I think it was just driving them crazy because the electronics just weren't there. It wasn't available at the time. The technology wasn't available at the time. So, 24 years later, like I mentioned, in 2005, Chrysler came out with that 300C and then the Dodge Magnum RT that used deactivated cylinders in the 5.7 liter Hemi engine. So you could operate on 8 or 4 cylinders. They didn't try to go with the in-between step, the 6 cylinders.
Yeah.
It was either 8 or 4, and it worked incredible. And, that was the worry when they first came out with it was that, here we go again. There's going to be a lot more problems. But, of course, they had developed it and tested it and for years probably, and it worked flawlessly. It was a great engine.
So, speaking of fantastic segues.
Yeah.
Let's go to number 3.
And fantastic engines. This BRM H16, which BRM stands for British Racing Motors. So, you can see that this is going to be an interesting one here right from the get-go.
Yep.
This is a 1950s Formula One engine. And it's pretty incredible, Ben. It's a it's an H layout. So it's like, think about two flattened V8 engines that are geared together at the cams in the middle.
Right. So we have another 16-cylinder vehicle on our list. And like the earlier example, it's easy to mistake this for two V8s, but they're not... they're not really separate anymore because they're united by that cam.
Well, they are. They're joined together. I mean, these are, think about it like two V8s just laid down on their side and then, and stuck together right in the middle. And that's how they're operating. And that's exactly the way it is. Now, they can be either atop one another in an H layout. They can either be atop one another or they can be beside one another. Now, each has its own crankshaft, but they're geared together at the camshaft. So the cams are where they come together. So these are geared together at the cams.
And, this stuff is incredibly heavy.
Yeah, it's a huge engine. I mean,
it's
when you look at
a monster.
It looks like it's on a pallet of some kind of metal pallet, you know,
sure.
This photo. But again, this was used in Formula One engines, Formula One cars from the 1950s. And, you know, these are 64-valve engines, you know, four valves per cylinder. Extremely high output. 600 horsepower is what these things would put out. And they had some advantages. They had some disadvantages. Which we'll talk about in just a second, but this wasn't the only one. I mean, there were other H layout engines, right? There was a smaller one.
Yeah, from, also from BRM, 1.5 liter with two 750cc V8s.
Yeah, that's right. And again, same thing, you know, the gears that rested between the cylinder banks, were actually protected by, I don't know if I should say protected by, but maybe protected by a flame trap, that was made by Rolls-Royce, which came from a Merlin Spitfire engine, which prevented unburnt fuel from the supercharger from making its way back into the combustion chamber. And as they point out here in this article, the sound is absolutely amazing with these things. And I did listen to it with headphones on and high volume, and it makes a huge difference between that and like the speakers on your laptop or something. I mean, it really pays off to listen to them where you can really hear these engines because they sound gorgeous. They're really nice.
And one note, Lotus used these. Right, and when they were racing,
they did. Yeah, as a matter of fact, Lotus. One person that you may recognize the name Jim Clark.
Mm-hmm.
He won the 1966 U.S. Grand Prix in a Lotus 43 using this engine.
So this is another award-winning engine.
Exactly right, and they do have some advantages, as I mentioned, and some disadvantages. Now, the advantages: excellent mechanical balance. I mean, they're really perfectly balanced, and that really pays off in racing. Now, disadvantages. They have a high center of gravity, and they're also heavy and complex with gear-driven twin overhead cams for each of the four cylinder heads, which already that sounds complex, right?
Mm-hmm.
Two gear-coupled camshafts and mechanical fuel injection.
And if that doesn't sound, if you're thinking, well, that's okay, I'm fine with that, that makes sense, keep it simple, you should also keep in mind that their original plans were for four valve heads and six camshafts.
Yeah, now think about this. I mean, so it's super complex, right? But think about these numbers. This is a 1.5 liter engine. So, you know, it's this enormous thing, but it's 16 cylinders. It has 600 horsepower. And get this, it spins at 12,000 revolutions per minute. And it's supercharged. So all of this, you know, all this power and all this complexity and everything, think about 1950s race cars. Think about how skinny those hard little tires were in the back. And imagine flying around a racetrack in that. Just how brave must have Jim Clark been and the fellows, you know, of that era.
And speaking of supercharging, we have come to number two on our list, the Auto Union V16.
Mm-hmm. And we've talked about this one in the past as well, but only in passing. I think we mentioned it maybe on a Nuts and Bolts episode because there's one little fact, and I might as well just throw it out there, like just to show you how complex these engines are before we really talk about them. The crankshaft alone on one of these engines has 1,100 parts.
Yep.
1,100 parts in the crankshaft alone. Now, that's going to blow a lot of people's minds who put together engines. There's usually very few parts on a crankshaft.
Mm-hmm.
But again, 1,100 parts. And I think that has something to do with roller bearings and just overly complex in the design. Mm-hmm. But it's what they had to do back then because we're talking about engines from the 1930s.
Yep. This is one of our deep cuts, ladies and gentlemen. It only has one camshaft. So they kept that part simple.
One camshaft. Okay. So it's a single overhead cam. Got
it.
And, but I mentioned that overly complex crankshaft. And, here's the thing, you know, these engines, these V16 engines were designed, it was a Porsche design, originally. Mm-hmm. And they were later replaced by V12s that developed, about 550 horsepower. We should talk about some of the specs in just a minute.
Yeah.
But I want to tell you how powerful these things were. Wheel spin could be induced at over 100 miles per hour. So let's say you're driving at 100 miles per hour in these things, in a Grand Prix race.
Right.
You shift into another gear, accelerate, and it's enough power to throw the back end out again because there's so much power. It's going to spin the wheels while you're already going over 100 miles an hour.
That's crazy.
It's incredible amount of power. I mean, between 1935 and 1937, auto unions won 25 Grand Prix races and driven by about five different drivers here. You'll probably recognize a couple of the names, but Ernst von Delius, Tazio Nuvolari, Bernard Rosemeyer, Hans Stuck, and a guy named Achille Varzi, I think is his last name. I didn't recognize that last one, but Hans Stuck and Rosemeyer and Nuvolari, of course, those are names we've mentioned in our Grand Prix podcast.
Yeah.
Those are some of the bigger names, but auto unions just dominated, the Formula One series or the Grand Prix series, I guess, prior to World War II with those drivers, them along with Mercedes, because the auto union cars and the Mercedes cars were both called the Silver Arrow cars. And we've heard the Silver Arrow name brought back into Formula One again by Mercedes recently.
Yeah.
The Silver Arrow thing is a bit of a heritage thing for them. But again, prior to World War II, they were just dominating everything about the Grand Prix series.
And looking at the specs can tell us why. They've got, 3-liter engine. I don't think we mentioned that part.
No, 3-liter engine, that's right. And, again, it's a V16, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Type A? Let's go through them, Type A, B, C, and D.
Sounds great.
So Type A was 1934. It's a V16. It had one supercharger, and it put out about 291 horsepower. The top speed, Ben, 174 miles per hour. That's pretty strong, right?
Yeah, especially given the time.
Yeah, I think about 1934 traveling at 174 miles an hour. And then look at a photo of a Type A auto union and see if you would want to travel 174 miles an hour in that thing. I mean, you've got those steering wheel at your chest, in your lap. It's a giant, almost like a tractor steering wheel. It's huge.
Yeah.
And there's there's nothing around you. I mean, your body is out in the open from about your waist up. Mm-hmm. You're sitting very high in the car, and they've got that little leather cap on with, the goggles.
Yeah,
that's
right.
About it, really.
Yeah.
I mean, they're really, really, extremely brave to do this. Type B, which was 1935, so 1 year advanced, and, still V16, still one supercharger, but they upped it to 370 horsepower. The top speed was not listed, but I'm sure that went up. Type C, which was 1936 to 1937, and this is kind of the last of the V16s for the auto unions. They had one or two superchargers on these engines, and the horsepower went way up, 478 horsepower if you had one supercharger. If you had two superchargers, you could count about 513 horsepower out of that engine.
That's insane for that time.
513 horsepower in that car in 1937, 36, whenever. Top speed, 211 miles per hour.
That's great.
That's amazing. That's what we saw Lamborghinis recently.
Uh-huh.
We were standing next to supercars, that cost more than our houses. I mean, they're $400,000 cars.
Sure, yeah, easily.
And they, their top speed is 210, 211, maybe 207, something like mm-hmm. that. Here's a car from 1937 that was doing 211 miles per hour with very, very little safety in mind for the driver. And then in type D in 1938, they went back down to V12 that was about the same power, but, the V16s were over at that point.
That's,
just the engine itself has a great history. The cars have a great history. The drivers have a great history. The company itself, Auto Union, that's interesting in itself.
We've never done a show on Auto Union.
We haven't, and we definitely should because that's a group of automakers that came together, back when that, was really, remarkable that the whole thing worked out.
They were kind of like the Avengers of their time.
Yeah,
what I mean?
It was a pretty good group.
And here's something weird. Before we continue, guys, I want to give a big shout out to our Car Stuff super producer, Noel Brown. Noel, as you know, usually when I give you a shout out, it means that I'm about to ask for a sound cue. So maybe not a drum roll, but something weird as we go into number one. Perfect. So the last on our list, perhaps one of the weirdest ones, is the Adams Farewell Radial Rotary.
OK, Okay, this is really, really strange. Now, this is one that, and I'll just tell you right up the, off the front here.
Yeah.
There's one vehicle that has this engine in it that exists today. Just one. So, the example that they show in this article, you know, there's a video that goes along with this. So you can see the operation of the engine. But there's only one left, and it showed up at a concourse event. I believe it was in, Pebble Beach back in 2011 that we see it. But it's a rotary engine. Not a radial engine. Now that's kind of confusing because the name of this thing is the Adams Farewell Radial Rotary. And it's truly a rotary engine because, this is so strange, the engine rotates around the crankshaft. The whole engine spins. The crankshaft remains stationary.
Yeah, the crankshaft is fixed. When it first was demonstrated in 1898, they had a four-stroke piston engine. So at the time, it had three cylinders that would rotate around the crankshaft. And he wasn't the only guy experimenting with this technology back then. There were other manufacturers who said, hey, what if we just spin the engine?
But this is a little bit different, and it's in a car, which is so strange. I mean, you open up the back engine and there's this little compartment where this engine is just whirring away, and it's only got like something like 20 horsepower or something like that.
Right.
But, incredible that they were working on this. Now, it's not anything like the rotary engines of today. It's not like a Wankel rotary engine that we've talked about in this podcast.
Yeah, no, not a bit.
It's nothing like that. So this is a four-stroke piston engine, which has either three or five cylinders that rotate around this fixed crankshaft, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think later they experimented with seven cylinders,
yep.
Right?
They also had this pretty neat marketing, widely considered to be an alternative technology, an alternative engine technology, because as we said, a lot of people were experimenting with these. But there were some pluses and minuses. For instance, it was air-cooled, so that worked because, you know, think about it, as the engine is moving, it's getting more and more air flowing over it. Apparently they had really good balance. They didn't need a whole lot of plumbing, and it didn't weigh very much.
Yeah, that's right. It was just 190 pounds for this whole thing, including the flywheel.
Mm-hmm.
So very, very low weight and smooth operation. I mean, it operated extremely smoothly. It was a well-running engine. It was a fine-tuned engine, I guess, if you want to call it that, you know, even back then. I mean, it runs a little bit rough, you know, according to, the way modern engines run, but honestly, it worked fairly well and it was reliable, et cetera, right?
Yeah.
The other thing, Ben, is that, you know, we said that it's air-cooled, and you would think that it would get awful hot in, you know, the body styles back then.
Right.
Because there's an awful lot of effort put into cooling air-cooled engines, you know, how the airflow goes over them. We've learned that through Volkswagen and Porsche. Et cetera,
sure, sure.
That through the ages. But this one, because the engine is constantly spinning around like that, it's constantly drawing air over the fins of, you know, the cooling fins on the engine. Once this guy shut this engine down, he could touch the engine. He couldn't lay his hand on it, but he could touch the engine, and it wasn't going to burn his fingers. It was warm, but it wasn't extremely or overly hot.
Which is very interesting. Mm-hmm. But one of, to me, the largest con of this engine, it goes back to the oil as the speed picks up.
Mm-hmm.
Because it did have an oil feed from the center, right? But the center of the engine, rather. But as the speed increased, the oil pressure would build up, and the engine itself would become thirstier and thirstier. So there's this great article in Hemmings that we checked out about this. And this means that it could also lose efficiency with speed. This makes it one of those vehicles that you would have to kind of perform routine maintenance on, like every third time you drove it, which was not at all abnormal for cars in the first era of the 20th century.
No, not at all. But what you're saying is that, let's say this engine is rated at 20 horsepower and X number of pound feet of torque.
Sure.
Right? They didn't really rate them at that at this point. But let's say that you've got a 20 horsepower engine in this car, and it operates at 20 horsepower at certain speeds.
Yeah.
But as you go faster and faster, it decreases its ability to go faster and faster. You know, it requires more effort. So, you know, you're losing power as you're going faster. So there's a
diminishing return.
Yeah. There's a sweet spot in there.
Yeah.
You know,
you
want to drive it where it's operating at optimal efficiency. Now, you know, after years of development of this Adams Farewell automobile, which was built, by the way, in Dubuque, Iowa.
Yeah.
It finally went on sale in 1905, and it was sold in very small numbers through about 1911.
Which I think is cool because, mm-hmm. This, you know, let's also keep in mind that this, it seems like a crazy idea to me. I understand it wasn't at the time, but
It wasn't because of aviation, because there were ideas that, you know, we're going to use this for, you know, some experimental aircraft. I mean, they were thinking even about experimental helicopters in 1910, which is way, way back farther than I thought they would. So they were thinking about using a 5-cylinder or possibly even a 7-cylinder engine like this in a helicopter in 1910.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty remarkable. And just one of these 5-cylinder helicopter engines, these prototype engines, I guess, made it or, you know, lived through the history. To be able to make it to the Smithsonian Institution where you can find it today.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only one Adams Farewell automobile, which is a 1906 Model 6A that survives right now.
That's the Pebble Beach one.
That is the Pebble Beach one. And you can see that see that engine running, that vehicle. You can hear the, I don't know if it's the curator of the museum or who it is, somebody that came out from the museum with the car, to describe its operation. And, you know, the guy that came with it, it's owned by the National Automobile Museum, which is housing the Hera collection. Remember the infamous Bill Hera collection out in Nevada.
Uh-huh.
And they've got some of the vehicles, if not all of the vehicles from the Hera collection in the National Automobile Museum now. So these cars are kind of making their way out to different shows, and everybody can get to see them that way if you don't make it to the museum itself.
Mm-hmm.
But it's worth going to this Jalopnik article just to see that Adams Farewell in operation, because it's so unusual, so unique, very strange.
Yeah, you know, it'd be amazing to be able to make it out to that car museum one day.
Oh, it really would. I've seen the collection in Las Vegas, and I don't know who. It's the Imperial Palace collection.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of like a like an old parking structure that they've carpeted, and you know, you walk up and down the rows, and beautiful stuff. And I think it's all for sale.
Mm-hmm.
They had Johnny Carson's car for sale there for a while. They have some customs and hot rods and just some really unusual vehicles that are there, and it's a constantly changing collection. So you can go once and then go back, you know, a few months later and check it out again, and there may be something new there. But I've never been to the Hera collection or the National Automobile Museum.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the Hera collection was in Reno, Nevada. I think it was at one point. I don't know where the National Automobile Museum is, but we should make a field trip.
Yeah. Surely let's get our slips together, have our parents sign off, and, well, or I guess in our case, I'll have to run it by, my boss at my house, which is my girlfriend.
Ah, we all knew that.
Yeah, I know. I'm hoping for a promotion, right? Boom. So, we hope that you guys have enjoyed this episode. We have added another engine show to our list of engine shows. There was another one that we forgot to mention at the top, I think, the world's largest engine. Remember when we did that one?
Oh, yes, we did. Yeah.
Yeah. And that thing is bananas.
Yeah.
It's, you can see, some great clips of the people starting. It's an engine for cargo ship, I want to say.
And as far as I know, the record still stands. And I think that's still the largest.
I mean, I can't imagine how you would build something bigger or what it would power.
No idea.
You know, that's a question. If you build an engine larger than that engine, you're doing it just to say that you built the biggest engine.
To power the earth
to make sure that the orbit continues. So let us know if you have any experience with some of these engines, like Scott's unfortunately burdened grandfather driving that 864, right?
Yeah, he got rid of it eventually.
Yeah, well, that's good. I'm glad he doesn't still have that albatross around his neck.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And, or if you have, if you think that we have been unfair to one of these engines, if you think that I'm giving the 864 a hard time unnecessarily, then let us know about your experience. And you can check out all of our episodes about engines on our website, carstuffshow.com. And of course, we are on Facebook, we are on Twitter, and we want to hear from you. Many of our best episode ideas come from you listening at home or in your car or truck right now. So go ahead and write to us directly. Our email address is
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.